The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Light of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish thought and practice based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKolel, Dean of the Kolel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America.
This lecture, titled The Unbroken Chain, Torah Scholarship Throughout the Ages, is dedicated to the honor and merit of Mr. and Mrs. Paul and Betty Sherazin.
Masechta Avos, the Tractate Avos, begins with the chain of tradition, the Mesorah. This unbroken chain is the foundation of the entire oral law, the Torah Shebaal Peh. Avos begins describing that chain. Moshe kibbol Torah miSinai. Moshe received the Torah at Mount Sinai and gave it over to Yoshua, to Joshua. Joshua to the elders to the prophets, and the prophets gave it over to the men of the great assembly. They're describing in those few short words almost, this is almost 1,000 years of transmission. What did Moshe Rabbeinu, what did Moses himself receive at Mount Sinai? So the Gemara in Brachos, in Heyomad Aleph in 5a, Rabbi Levi ben Chama said in the name of Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, what is the meaning of the verse, and I will give you the tablets of stone and the law and the commandment which I have written that you may teach them? This was the commandment, this was the conversation that God had with Moses before he went up to the mountain. After hearing the Ten Commandments, after the Aseres HaDibros, he told him that sentence. And the Gemara interprets that, explains that I will give you the tablets of stone, of course, refer to the Ten Commandments. The law, the Torah, the guide, refers to the Pentateuch. In other words, refers to really the narrative stories. In all probability, when he first went up to Mount Sinai, that which he received was the narrative up to, you know, up to the that time in, you know, in history. You know, as events unfolded, of course, he received further, you know, further prophecies and further narratives. But he received at least a text. The commandment, this is the Mishnah, that's the oral law, which I have written is an allusion, this extra word which I have written alludes to the teachings. These are the prophets and the And the holy writings, the Hagiographa, the other holy writings, the information contained in the other holy writings, again, were given to Moses at Mount Sinai. That you may teach them, this is the Gemara. This is the final process of the reasoning that goes into practical halacha, the practical law. It's based. The Mishnah are the principles, but the Gemara is really to translate those principles into practicality. And this passage concludes, it teaches us that all these things were given to Moshe on Sinai. In other words, Moses received in his prophecy was not just merely the words of the Torah Shebiksav, of the written Torah, that which is contained in the scroll of the Torah, but the ideas of the Torah. This is the Torah Shebaal Peh. In fact, Rosham Shafol Hirsch explains that the relationship between the Torah Shebaal Peh and the Torah Shebiksav, between the oral and the written, is similar to the relationship that one has as a college professor gives a lecture and the student is furiously writing down notes. those notes are a much abbreviated form of the lecture. And probably each student has his own style of note making. One has to know, in terms of the rules that go into the taking the notes, and before one could reconstruct the lecture just by looking at the notes. So too, the Torah Shebiktav, the written Torah, are really the notes. But the full range of ideas are in the Torah Shebal Peh, the oral tradition. And the oral tradition is what Moshe Rabbeinu gave over to Yoshua, to Joshua, and Joshua in turn to his disciples. It wasn't the actual Sefer Torah, the book, the scroll, because that actually was given, as the Torah itself describes, this was given to the Levites and was put into the Holy of Holies. And according to the Medrash, that was the official version. He made 12 other versions, I mean the same ones, but they're given over to the tribes so they could copy it, and each one will have the access to the written Torah. But that which Moshe gave to Joshua, as all this begins, Moshe received the Torah at Sinai and gave it over to Joshua, Yeshua is referring to the oral Torah, the ideas of the Torah, the corpus of law and ideas. Why is it that this corpus remained in an oral form for some 1800 years of our history? And why wasn't it immediately written down? And there are various theories why this is so. One is the idea of the importance of having a Rebbe, in other words, having a mentor to teach you directly all these ideas, is that once something is written down, it has a life of its own. It's open to its own interpretation. I mean, see the problems we have with the Constitution. Once it's written down, it says, it's like a Gemara. You could touch it up like this. You could interpret like this, like that. If you heard it directly, you know what it means. So that's one theory is why the importance of why it had to remain in an oral form, really to preserve its integrity. There's another theory which is offered, is that once you're studying from a written form, you're not dealing with a person living through the Torah. You're not studying under a model who has absorbed and integrated all these ideas into his own life. You're dealing with a lifeless book. But you don't know exactly, it would be, you have no idea, like, how do you live this? You're just, it would be the equivalent of reading the words of a song but not knowing the melody. So you could hum it this way, you could hum it that way. We have on Shabbos table, who knows how many different nagunim, how many songs there are for different words. But imagine, having studied something, not just the words, but from the composer himself. It's a different thing entirely. It isn't just the words, it's the official melody. When you study Torah from a Torah scholar, it isn't just a matter of information. It's a question of the song, of the attitudes, of how you live life. You're studying under a living embodiment of Torah. It makes a totally different impression on the person, and really it's a much more reliable source of what really it is to be a Torah Jew. And originally that's the way it was until it became impossible because of the persecution and other factors that they could no longer maintain it in its pure oral form, and it had to be written down. But even when it's written down, even to this day, and even when Gemaras have already been translated, without really going to a yeshiva and going studying by a Rebbe, it's still quite inaccessible. But then, really, it was the whole, every word was gotten from a living Sefer Torah. In that sense, we could understand this, a Gemara in Brachos and Zayin Amud Beis that explains Gedoyah L'Shimusha Yoyser Milimuda. It's greater serving a scholar, in other words, having a direct relationship with a scholar, than actually studying itself. It speaks about Elisha, who was the successor of Eliyahu, of Elijah the prophet, and he was the one who washed Elijah's hands. He had that intimate relationship with him. You can learn an awful lot by having a personal relationship with someone. You see how he makes a bracha. You see how he davens, how he talks. You can see when events occur, what is his immediate reaction? And in that sense, one could understand the value of having the entire Torah being maintained in an oral form. We just touched upon the idea of what is it meant that Moshe received the Torah, what was the Torah that Moses received at Sinai. We explained the idea that he handed it over to Yoshua, to Joshua. Why was it important that he personally hand it over? Why was it important the Torah be handed over directly from one generation to the other? It's interesting, though, the Mishnah begins with Moshe Kibbol Torah Misinai, from Sinai. It doesn't say Moshe Kibbol Torah Makodesh Baruch Hu, from the Holy One, blessed be He. I mean, that probably, if I would be writing, you know, such a thing, it says, where does it start? You know, you start, Moses received it from Hashem. And in turn, he gave it to Yeshua. I mean, he received it from Sinai. And even there's a problem with the grammar. I mean, you see, he would see that at Sinai, Eitzel Sinai, Al Sinai, Al Sinai, Al Har Sinai. What's it, Miz Sinai? I mean, there's an understanding, the commentators understand that means to he who appeared at Mount Sinai, from the one who came to Mount Sinai. That's still strange. I'd like to read to you, says the Rambam, Maimonides, in the eighth chapter of Hilchos Yesodei Torah. And he says, by what basis did the Jewish people place their faith in Moshe? And he continues, through the experience of being at Mount Sinai, where our own eyes saw, not those of a stranger, and our own, and this is really paraphrasing the words of Moshe Rabbeinu himself, our own ears heard, not at someone else's, the fire, sounds, and lightning, and how Moshe went up to the thick darkness, and the voice spoke unto him, as we heard, saying, Moshe, Moshe, go say to them such and such. That's the wording that we have in our text of Maimonides. According to the Sefer Akedah, it was written in the early 1400s, the text should read, that they heard not only the Ten Commandments, they heard after the Ten Commandments, when the Jews said, it's too intense for us, and you, Moshe, be the go-between between us and Hashem. He went back to the mountain, and they heard Hashem's reply. And the reply was, return again into your tents for the people. But as for you, referring to Moses, stand here by me, and I will speak to you all of the commandments and the statutes and the judgments which you shall teach them, and they may do them in the land which I give them to possess. In other words, what they heard was not only the original Ten Commandments, but according to this text in the Rambam, they also heard when Moses went back to the mountain that Hashem agreed, okay, so they can go back home, You stay here and I will teach you the rest. And again, based on this idea that the Jews themselves heard, similarly as stated in Scripture, the Rambam continues, this is from Parsha Veschanan, Deuteronomy 5:4, the Lord talked with you face to face. This is a point that Moses makes repeatedly. The Jews, it's a historical experience, it's something you yourself experienced. In other words, the Jews were convinced, not by any logical proof, but just by experientially, empirically, that this is the Word of God. So therefore, saying from perhaps by the fact that we say Mesinai, from the Lord who appeared at Sinai, says there were no doubts. You know, and it's interesting to contrast this, the view of Judaism, which is really based upon our history. You know, history is so important for the Jews. Every Seder, you know, twice a year, Jews come together and repeat, says, go through our origins. And this is a ceremony that has occurred generation after generation. How many of remembers as their parents' Seder, the grandparents' Seder, and the grandparents before their grandparents' Seder? It's gone on for thousands of years. It's that the history is really so much part of what it is to be a Jew. Because the basis of Judaism really is based on, is experiential. We were there. We experienced it. Contrast that, for instance, with Christianity. Really, the basis of what of his prophecy or what he was supposed to have told them, right, is nothing that they experienced. It's something which he themselves told them, if we are to believe those who wrote the book. But subsequently, which is even more important, that what the idea that we have, more or less from the Gospels, is that Yeshua was a practicing Jew, as were the original apostles. It was only some years after his death that a new prophecy came and said that the old prophecy, the old Torah, is no longer in effect, and now there's a new era and a new prophecy. There's a new covenant. And that's why it's called the New Testament. And the Testament means a covenant, which is indicative that this is new. I mean, Jeremiah, Yirmiyahu, in chapter 33 describes a new covenant. But this was their whole new interpretation of this, that God now has come and created a new covenant. Then the old covenant is no longer in effect. And Jews, therefore, are not required to keep the Torah. You know, it would have been nice, you know, when the Torah, this is a point that Moses Mendelssohn makes and others as well. You know, when the Torah was given, God took the entire Jewish people, all those that it affected, and told them directly, this is what I want you to do. There are no doubts. Now when God says, no, forget about it, he tells somebody who's really not part even of the mainstream of Judaism anymore, you know, who's on a fringe group, and not necessarily extremely educated either, and not a leader of the people. Just one person tells them, forget it. And this we're supposed to believe. You know, there's a whole parsha, a whole section of Torah about a Navi Sheker. You know, a prophet who comes with signs. They didn't even come with signs. It comes with signs and all kinds of supernatural feats to say, he says, that God has told him something which just contradicts the eternity of the Torah. He's put to death. And yet, we're supposed to rely, we the Jews who've had this experience are supposed to rely upon the so-called prophecy of these people. Either Paul or Peter. I mean, it's really no wonder the Jews did not accept Christianity. And it's a wonder that the Christians never got it. They don't realize why we had such a problem with this. I mean, which is amazing. I mean, they called us all kinds of names and were stubborn. But, you know, there's really, logically, there's really no reason for the Jews to, you know, have given up what they felt was a historical, based on historical experience. You know, if Moses says, if God had wanted to change everything, he should have got them, all, every single Jew, back together and spoke to them like he spoke to them the first time. Why didn't he? It was so important. That's why the Jews never accepted. And when it came to Muhammad, you know, that he also, he, at least to the extent that he knew, you know, but he accepted the prophecy of Moses. And yet, you know, he has a new prophecy from the, supposedly from the angel Gabriel. And again, that the old prophecy is no longer in effect. No one saw Gabriel speak to him. No one knows this. And again, that's why the Jews never accepted Islam. And it really is the claim that, you know, and the Torah itself makes the claim. Has there ever been any nation on earth who's ever even made the claim that God has spoken to all of them? There's no one who's even made the claim, because it's, either it happens or it doesn't happen. If it doesn't happen, you can't make, you can't fabricate it. So, according to this, then, the reason that it says, Misinai, we received it from Sinai, was to stress the fact that it was based on this experience of Mount Sinai. Now, there were no doubts. Now, for Moshe, the oral law, the Torah Shel Baal Peh, was in turn passed down, as we said, from one generation of scholars to the next. In fact, the Torah assumes there always will be scholars who will be expert in the Torah. And it says, for instance, in Parsha Shoftim, this is in Deuteronomy 17:8 till 17:11, it says, if there rises a matter too hard for you in judgment between blood and blood, different types of blood, the halachic status, between plea and plea, between plague and plague, between matters of controversy based on Jewish law inside your gates. Again, the idea of gates always refers to the courts, because the courts were the courts, it seems, were placed at the entrance of the gate. And as they had walled cities, and people from the rest countryside would go to the city to for their legal decisions. There would be one gate, so to speak, that a city had, because it was totally walled. And by the gate, you know, either inside the gate or sure, was the room where the Beis Din was. So people didn't have to go through the entire city to go to the Beis Din, because they would just go directly to the Beis Din and go back home. Wasn't designed by architects, you know. By architects, they make sure that you go through the entire store until you want to get to your item, you know, so you'll buy on an impulse everything. You can imagine, you know, this way to the Beis Din, you have all the hawkers and all the stores and all the... But that was not the case. The Beis Din was right by the city gates. And if you have a question, what should you do? And it's not, and it wasn't resolved by the local courts, and that's it's inside your gate. Like the local court had this problem, was unresolved. Then she will rise and go to the place which the Lord your God shall choose, and you shall come to the priests, the Levites, and to the judge, and whether the judge even is not a Levite, who shall be in those days, and inquire, and they shall declare to you the sentence of judgment. In other words, it assumes, because there will always be, if there are questions, there are people who will answer your questions. It assumed that the Jews would remain educated and continue on this scholarly tradition. How well was this oral tradition preserved? Because we've described the idea that Moses received it in a way that there was no doubt from the Jewish people themselves. And he gave it over to this group and to that group. How well was it preserved? It's interesting, there's a Gemara in Temura, in Tesvavam and Bezim 15b. It says, we've learned in a Mishnah elsewhere, this is in the end of Sota, when Yosi ben Yoezer of Tzreda and Yosef ben Yochanan of Yerushalayim died, the Ish Eshkolis, the grape clusters, came to an end. So the Gemara says, what does that mean, Eshkolos, grape clusters? So we know Eshkol is a grape cluster, but it also, it was a contraction, or it was a common expression that Ish Eshkolos is Ish, a person that had kol, had everything. In other words, was a multifaceted scholar, saint, that in all areas he had expertise. That's Ish Eshkolos. A man in whom all the Torah, fear of God, and loving kindness is contained. And the last that we could point out, you know, that existed was this Yosef ben Yoezer, Yisrael Yosef ben Yochanan of Yerushalayim, who lived at the eve of the Maccabee revolt. In other words, the Maccabee revolt was circa around the year 165 before the Common Era. That's when they died. That marks the end of their life. And Rabbi Yehuda reported in the name of Shmuel all the grape clusters. In other words, the Shkolos, these people who were experts across a whole swath of fields, who rose from the days of Moses until Yosef ben Yoezer learned Torah like Moshe, our teacher. From that time onward, they did not learn Torah like Moshe, our teacher. In other words, the original Torah was totally preserved. And then from that time, it started. This is he had the problem with the Maccabees, and there were several problems, and there was a whole decline. But up until that point, at least the Gemara understood, the tradition of the Talmud was that actually it was preserved one generation to the next generation without having lost anything in the process. There is, though, a notion, even though this is in terms of the information, but there is a notion that as generations go further away from Mount Sinai, there's really something lost. Maybe not, at least up until that, you know, well over 1,000 years in content, but there's something lost during the process. And there's an amazing Gemara on Shabbos in Kufyud Beis. The Rebbe Zera said, the Rebbe of Rabbi Zimuna, if the earlier scholars, and Rishonim says, B'nai Malachim, if the earlier scholars were sons of angels, if we view them as such, that we are, says Anu B'nai Anoshim, then we're sons of men. If we look at ourselves, we're men, well, who are they? They were the sons of angels. If the earlier scholars were sons of men, says, but if we look, they were just people, then what are we? We're like donkeys. And not even like the donkeys of Chanina ben Deiser and Pinchas ben Yoar that seem to have psychic ability, but simple, ordinary donkeys. Because if we can, they're people, then we're donkeys. There's a sense of a loss from generation to generation. You know, it's similar, like to the, you know, if you're familiar with the second law of thermodynamics, the law of entropy, that energy becomes less efficient, you know, as it changes from one form to another, till finally it just dissipates into non-effective energy, non-directed energy. There is a loss, so to speak. If it wasn't the content, it was the fervor, it was. And there's a certain sense as well that we know the prophecy came to an end during the beginning of the Second Temple period. That was some 200 years before the death of Yosef ben Yoezer. Prophecy came to an end. It would seem the ability to keep all this information, in other words, to retain all of this enormous amount of information, you know, according to one major source, that the original, our Mishnayos, our Mishnah, which is in a very cryptic and condensed form, but contains, it's arranged in six sdorim, six orders. The original Mishnah had 600 orders. In other words, it was 100 times as large. So there's an awful lot of information. And it was a Torah Shebal Peh, and it was retained orally. And it would seem as it was like it was a God-given gift to retain all that knowledge. It wasn't just that they were so much more brilliant, perhaps, you know, other generations. I don't know if IQs have changed, but it's a matter of the siyata d'shmaya, of God's hand has changed. Now it's much more obvious. You know, then it was much more, it was obvious, you know, that the God's presence was there. And it was less, it became less obvious. So you have, so it seems that the shikhas ha-Torah, the forgetting of the Torah, is really, it goes hand in hand with a diminishing presence of God, you know, amongst the Jewish people. We find after the destruction of the Second Temple, it seems to be a precipitous drop. But there is this idea that it starts from Sinai, you know, and this is going on the fuel of all that original inspiration. And as it goes from generation to generation, there is a certain diminishing of that inspiration, that divine presence, and as a result, there's less which is retained. I'd just like to end this part of the lecture with a beautiful little story, again, about the idea, we're speaking about the Masorah up until now, how it's handed down, and about that even though the truth is that, you know, we are studying Torah like our grandfathers, our grandparents, or their grandparents before us. But still, as we said, that there's a certain diminishing. There's a beautiful story of Yaakov Kamenetsky, who was one of the great Talmid Chachamim, one of the great scholars of the past generation. He died just about 18 years ago. He was a Rosh Yeshiva, Yeshiva's Torah Vadas, and he was on an airplane with a grandchild. And his grandchild, of course, as you know, as it is amongst, you know, very, you know, pious religious, you know, homes, the grandchild treated the grandfather with the greatest respect and took care of him and served him and made sure that all his needs were taken care of. And there was another passenger on the airplane who was witnessing all of this, who was also Jewish, but not observant, who, after witnessing all of this, came to Rav Yaakov, came to the rabbi, and asked him, this is just amazing, you know, how your grandson relates to you and how he serves you. You know, it's too bad that my grandson, you know, doesn't act to me, you know, in a similar way. So Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, you know, asked him, you believe in the theory of evolution? He says, yeah. Well, according to theory of evolution, says, you know, as it goes on, the more progress we make, right? Because we start off with an ape. So in a certain sense, you are closer to your simian ancestors, in other words, to your ape ancestors, than your grandson, who has already progressed two more generations. You know, so why should he respect you? You should respect your son, your grandson. We, on the other hand, view that really the apex of the zenith of human spirituality was reached at Mount Sinai. The further we go from Mount Sinai, we're really diminishing our level. So I'm that closer as a grandfather, or that closer to the experience of Sinai. So that's why he respects me, and why your grandson does not respect you. No, but it's an interesting, it says a lot. The order of, again, of Pirkei Avos, has it, Moshe received the Torah from Sinai, gave it over to Yeshua to the Zakenim, to the elders. Simply, the elders were the students of Yeshua. And it says, Zakenim, says, gave Masarua l'Nevi'im. They gave it over to the prophets. There is an inherent problem historically. The prophets, the period of the prophets, we normally consider began with Shmuel HaNavi, with Samuel the prophet. I mean, from that period of time, which was the period right before, including the monarchy. This is like some 400 years from the time that Moses died. You know? The Zakenim, the elders, well, these were Joshua's disciples. Joshua outlived Moses from some 28 years. How long could have the elders outlived Joshua? How do we get from the death of Joshua and the elders to the time of the prophets? There's just too much of a gap. In Ovest Rabbi Nosson, which is an expanded version, a parallel, Pirkei Avos. It's like a Brisa, Tosefta in Avos. It has a middle step. It has Zakenim Leshoftim, to the judges. There's a period of judges that lasted some 350 years of judges. In fact, that there's a work from the Gaonic period, from the 9th century, that lists every single judge in describing the Seder Mekabli HaTorah, in other words, the order, to Joshua, to the elders, to Azniel ben Knaz, in order to go from to Ehud ben Gera, in other words, to go from one judge to the next judge and list all the judges. But our Mishnah in Pirkei Avos does not. And neither does the Rambam. Maimonides does not list the judges. According to rabbinic tradition, Pinchas, who was one of the elders, who was the member of the entourage of Yeshua, Pinchas was the grandson of Aaron. He was a major figure, and he continued to be a major figure, according to rabbinic tradition, for many hundreds of years afterwards. He was blessed with an extremely old age. And it was Pinchas who was the last survivor of these Zakenim who handed it over to Eli HaKohen, who in turn handed over to Shmuel HaNavi. So he takes the link of the Zakenim, he puts it with Pinchas. And according to the Rambam, as he lists, and he goes through some 40 generations from Moses till the end to Rav Ashi, to the end of the Talmud, and list generation after generation, you know, who the leaders of that generation were, who were the students of the previous generations and the mentors of the next generation, and really describes this chain. No mention of the judges. Yet Ovest Rabbi Nosson, it's a parallel work to the Mishnah, mentions these judges. So how does one understand this? Another difficulty is that the judges weren't necessarily the greatest scholars. Many of them were, what seems, Yiftach. Many of them were not really, it seems, were not really scholars. So how could they be part of the chain of transmission? And it would seem that the chain of transmission, as understood by Ovest Rabbi Nosson, is perhaps different than the chain of transmission understood in our Mishnah of Ovis, and as the Rambam has this. The chain of transmission as in Ovis and as the Rambam has are who were the teachers. Moshe, Yeshua, everyone goes, you know, this is Yeshua, Pinchas, Eli HaKohen, Shmuel, these were all great scholars. But in every generation besides those who were the actual teachers, you need those who are the administrators, who are responsible that the generation knows Torah. And it would seem that the list of all the Rabbi Nosson are not necessarily the teachers of the generation, but those who are achroi, those who have the responsibility to make sure that the Torah is preserved. Because part of the job, therefore, in this understanding, the shoftim of the judges, not just to fight wars, to maintain internal peace, but to make sure that the highest level of education is maintained. I mean, if one would give a parallel in our generation, there happens to be one of the cabinet positions is the Department of Education. And it's the responsibility of the President of the United States to make sure that the level of education is maintained throughout this country. That is part, when you elect the president, that's part of his responsibility. And he's held accountable. And I'm sure if the level of education would slip considerably, his opponent from the other party would go and they'll be part of his platform and says if you elect me, says the problems of education will be solved and you're that's a response. The responsibility of a shofet was to make sure that the integrity of the Torah was preserved. And it would seem, therefore, that really the Ovis Rabbi Nosson and the Ovis are really describing two parallel transmissions, so to speak. One is a teacher to a student, and one is an administrator to the one who's his successor. But in that light, in the light of Ovis Rabbi Nosson, about the importance of preserving the Torah, and it's not in the preserving, not in terms of the teacher, the student-teacher relationship, but in terms of the responsibility of the generation. Perhaps we have another aspect of the importance of mentioning Sinai. You know, one of the questions that's asked, you know, at the Seder table, one of the difficulties is, you know, one of the highlights in the Seder is Dayenu. You know, every Jewish home, you know, saying Dayenu, you know, and they go through all the events that occurred. If this hadn't occurred, if only this had occurred, Dayenu would have been sufficient. Yet not only did that occur, but something else occurred. It kept saying this to that. One of those is, it says, Ilu kervono v'nei har Sinai. Had he brought us before Mount Sinai and had not given us the Torah, Dayenu, it would have been sufficient. And the question they ask is, that's the language. Notice, if you did this for us, you brought us to Mount Sinai, even if you didn't give us the Torah, that would have been fine. And most certainly now you brought us to Mount Sinai, you gave us the Torah. And the question they ask is, what is the purpose of bringing us to Mount Sinai if he's not going to give us the Torah? So according to what I said previously, at least the idea that they saw the vision, you know, that they saw the prophecy, even if the whole Torah had not been given, but at least they were assured that they were speaking to God, you know, that assurance would have justified it. But there may be another aspect as well. The Gemara says that what we achieve by the experience of being at Har Sinai, as the Gemara in the Dorim and Daf Chof in 20a, is that every Jew now has a sense of humility, a sense of embarrassed shyness. And there's, if a Jew does not have busha, a sense of a certain innate shyness, it's a sign he wasn't at, his ancestors were not at Mount Sinai. We went there, we experienced the trembling, you know, as it describes, you know, the Gemara says that whenever we study Torah, just as the original Torah, as we learn Brachos in 22a, in Chof Beis Amud Aleph, the original Torah is given in dread and fear and trembling and quaking. So here too, when one studies Torah, it must be dread, fear, trembling, quaking. We have to feel God's presence. Even when Moses went to get the Torah, in other words, after we all heard the Ten Commandments, he went up to the mountain. There's one opinion that he stayed there for 6 days in seclusion, also to get prepared. The Torah has to be studied not just as another academic discipline. You feel the presence of God. That sense that we feel God's presence on earth left an indelible mark on every Jew. And if you find a Jew that doesn't have that, one has to question the yichus, you know. If you don't have that, are you really Jewish? You know, there's a certain sense, you know, this is my own, you know, but deep down, and there's that every Jew really believes, no matter what he tells you, no matter what he does, every Yid is a mindman. There's something irrational, something he doesn't understand. There's something that attracts him, even if it attracts him to rebel against it. It bothers him that it attracts him, and he kicks and he screams and he has to create all kinds of theories. There's something inside says that, you know, deep down, says he knows it's true. So that's the legacy of Har Sinai. And that's why, he says, according to one reason, had he brought us to the mountain, even if he didn't give us the Torah, but he gave us that sense of spirituality, having that experience. Therefore, Moshe Kibbutz Torah miSinai, he received it from Sinai, is because Moses received the Torah from Sinai, having experienced it at Mount Sinai, is really means that we not just received information, but it was a whole emotional experience. Moses received the Torah from Sinai, having experienced it at Mount Sinai, is really means that we not just received information, but it was a whole emotional experience. We received Yirah Shamayim, the fear of God, we received at Mount Sinai. And when Moses handed over, says, to Yeshua, he didn't just give him information, but he gave him that sense, you know, of Yirah Shamayim. And according to the Ovis Rabbi Nosson, says, when he gave it over to the Shoftim, what he gave over was that sense of you have that responsibility. You can't take Torah lightly. Because it isn't you take it or you leave it. He says, this is our life. And if that sense, that feelings was passed over from generation to generation, if it's a list, as we say, not of teachers, but of administrators, an administrator has to know the urgency, the importance of what he's administering. In that sense, we could understand the idea that was given from Sinai. We're dealing with the emotion, with the Yirah Shamayim, with the fear of heaven. And that fear of heaven was passed down, you know, hand in hand with the Torah, and the responsibility to make sure that the Torah remains the living breath of the Jewish people. You know, it's akin to the Gemara brings a story in Samach Aleph on Beis in 61b, in Brachos, that when Rabbi Akiva defied the Romans and taught the Torah in public, he was a colleague of his, says, why are you risking your life for this? And he gave him an analogy. He says, once the fish were fleeing the fishermen, fleeing the nets of the fishermen, so a fox who was standing by shore says, what do you have to live a life like this? You're always afraid of the fishermen, the nets. Come up on the dry land with me and I'll take good care of you. You know, but so the fish says, told the fox, you know, if we have this is our lifeblood, our source of oxygen, our whole life is from the water. If we have a hard time existing, surviving, says, with while we're in the water, most certainly we're going to be, it says, our viability is going to be compromised if we go outside of the water. In other words, at least we have a fighting chance if we're in the water. Rabbi Akiva says, the Torah to the Jews is like water for a fish. If the Jews can't have the Torah, says, they don't have life. Therefore, basically, it's worthwhile to risk one's life to maintain that the Jews have the Torah, because if I stop teaching, there'll be nothing left of the Jews. They'll be left without Torah. So really, that sense of the urgency of what Torah is and God's presence on earth It's really something that also was handed down from generation to generation. I would like to, conclude with just to give you a feeling and notion of what the importance of what Torah meant to Jews. And we've discussed before the Torah was handed down. There was always systems of court systems. There were yeshivas. The Jews were quite literate. I'd just like to touch upon the fact about what their attachment to Torah was. In Ovis Rabbi Nosson, the beginning of the 28th chapter, says, Omer Rabbi Nosson, Ein lecha ava ta avas ha-Torah. There's no love like the love of Torah. You know, it's a theme that King David often repeats, David HaMelech and Tehillim. The very first Psalms begin with the first two verses of the entire book of Psalms begins as follows. Fortunate is the man does not walk in the counsel of the wicked, nor stands in the way of the sinners, nor sits in the seat of the scornful, but his delight is in the Torah of the Lord, and in his Torah does he meditate day and night. This is how it begins. And we say in the davening on Shabbos from the 19th Psalm, the Torah of the Lord is perfect, restoring the soul. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. You know, it goes on and on. It's really a hymn to the Torah. And the 119th Psalm, on the 97th verse, says, Mo so hafti Torah secha kol yom hisichasi. How I love thy Torah, it is my meditation all the day. Josephus, in his work against Apion, describing to non-Jews what it is to live a life as a Jew, he says, our principal care of all of this is to educate our children well. That's the most important thing for the Jews. And again, he writes further on in the work, but for our people, if anyone asks any of them about our laws, he will more readily tell him all that, says, tell all than he will tell his own name. This is in consequence of our having learned them as soon as we become sensible of anything and of our having them as if it were engraved on our souls. This is how Josephus, this is a description of, you know, the Jewish people. There's a beautiful story. I'm going to end the class with this story. It's a beautiful story. Again, give you insight of how classic what the love the Jews had, you know, to the Torah, and how important it was to hand it over to their children, to the next generation. And this story is taken from the Maggid Speaks. These are the stories which record a Pesach Kron that were told over by Shalom Shvadron, who was the Maggid of Jerusalem. I think it's worthwhile to say over the whole, to read over this whole story. It's a beautiful story. But it gives you a sense of what it is, how Jews view the Torah, and how important it was that their children should know the Torah. It should be passed down. We spoke about this chain of transmission from one generation to the next generation. That chain hasn't stopped. We're still in the process of that chain. In the last years of his life, the Ritvaz, Rav Yaakov, this is David Vilovsky, who lived between the years 1845 and 1913, lived in the holy city of Tzfas in Eretz Yisrael. That was the last years of his life. He was the Rav of Slutsk. He was a very prominent Rav. He was considered one of the Gaonim of his generation. He authored two classic commentaries on the Talmud Yerushalmi, the Ritvaz and Tosfos Arid, which are today published as part of almost every edition of the Talmud Yerushalmi, of the Jerusalem Talmud. And the story goes as follows. One winter afternoon in Tzfas, in Safed, on the day of his father's Yortzeit, the Ritvaz came to shul earlier than usual for Mincha, before most of the people had arrived. He went to a shtender, a lectern, rested his elbows on its surface, cupped his chin in his hands, became lost in thought. As he stood there for a few moments meditating, tears welled up in his eyes and slowly trickled down his cheeks. And then he started to cry softly to himself. The people in shul knew that the Rav had Yortzeit, so they respectfully respectfully kept their distance, assuming that he was lost in memories of the past. However, a close friend went to him and said, "Rav Yaakov Dovid, why are you so upset? Your father was 80 years old when he passed away, certainly not a youngster, and he died almost 50 years ago." "I'll tell you," said the Ritvaz, composing himself, and this is the story he related. "I was thinking of the time when I was a young boy, and my father arranged for me to have the best malam, a teacher in our town, a certain Reb Chaim Sender, as a private tutor. He charged 1 ruble a month, which was a large sum of money in those days, especially for my father, who was very poor. It took quite an effort to put the money together every month. My father made his living making furnaces for people. One winter, business was very bad because there was a shortage of cement and lime. My father couldn't meet the payments to Reb Chaim Sender. 3 months went by, and still he had not paid the Malamed, the teacher. Then one day I came home with a note from the Malamed, which said that if he did not get the money the next morning, he would be unable to continue teaching me. When my parents read the note, they were devastated. To them, my Torah study meant everything. They felt that nothing should stand in the way of my becoming a Talmud Chacham, a Torah scholar. When my father went to shul, to synagogue that evening, he heard a wealthy man complain that the contractors building a house for his son and future daughter-in-law could not get a furnace because of the cement and lime shortage. He offered 6 rubles to anyone who would get him a furnace. In Russia, a furnace was a vital household item, for it was used as both heat to heat the home and cook the food. When he came home from shul, he discussed the matter with my mother, and they agreed that my father should take apart our oven, brick by brick, and build a new one for the rich man. And that he would take his apart and then transport it and rebuild it. Then they would have the 6 rubles for my malamed. My father did just that, and received the 6 rubles, which he immediately gave to pay Reb Chaim Sender. "Tell the malamed," he said to me proudly, "3 is for back pay, and the other 3 are for the next 3 months for my Yankel Dovid." The winter was bitterly cold, and we all froze and shivered. All that so that I should have the best malamed, the best teacher, and grow in Torah. The Ritvaz paused, took a breath, and continued, "This afternoon it was cold outside, and I thought that maybe I should arrange for a minyan to my home instead of coming to shul. Then I decided in honor of my father I should make the extra effort to go to shul instead. When I came to shul a little while ago, I thought about the mesiras nefesh, the self-sacrifice of my father, my whole family during that bitter, cold winter just for me and my learning. That's why I cried, because I remembered the boundless affection and devotion that only parents can have so that their child should learn our holy Torah." That story, how outstanding it is, in a certain sense, captures, it's not atypical, really captures the essence of what Torah study meant for the Torah study of their children, it meant for Jewish parents. You know, Jewish mothers used to shake the crib, the singing a lullaby, says that their child should grow up to be a Talmud Chacham, to grow up to be a scholar. That which began Moshe Kibbutz Torah Mi-Sinai, says, did not just end with Moshe or Yeshua or the Zakenim or Nevi'im, but it continues on to this day. All of us are very much part of that chain. And of course we have to make sure, says, that it in turn will be passed on to the next generation. Okay, are there any questions?
We have assumptions to what transformation might take place with the Torah law and the Messianic age.
The question was asked about the Messianic age and the Torah Shebaal Peh, about the oral law. Yirmiyahu speaks, Jeremiah speaks about a whole new understanding of Torah. The prophet Isaiah speaks, Kemola Oretz Dea, the whole world will be filled with knowledge, Kemayim Liyam Mechasim, like water fills the basin of the seas. There'll be a whole new understanding of the Torah. And in that sense, of course, of all the arguments and all that has gone on will be, of course, reassessed. And so there'll be a whole new understanding. But ultimately, there's an understanding that all we can ultimately do is reconstruct the original prophecy, the original transmission that Moses had from Sinai and gave over to Yeshua. There won't be a new prophecy. Perhaps a deeper understanding of that original prophecy and a restoration of that which through the generations has been forgotten, but it won't be new. So the question was asked that it started off with 600 and it got down to 6. What happened with the rest? What happened with the rest is the brisos. In other words, that's what we call the other material that was preserved and quoted. It's really a remnant of that. But we find that it seems that much, the Mishnah really was a condensed form of all of this. And it seems that if one would know how to read Mishnah correctly, one could reconstruct much, between the lines. But nonetheless, it seems that besides those brises which were preserved in the Talmud Bavli and Yerushalmi and the Tosefta and all these various collections, there's a lot we don't have.
What did it deal with?
It dealt with probably on a much greater, a detailed form. Many of the situations of the laws were not common. Were not the most common. Were rather arcane. Kind of situations or laws. Rabbi Elezer ben Hyrcanus was bemoaning the fact when he died of the thousands of halachas that he knew, minutiae, that were with his death they are gone. And described laws of sorcery, thousands of laws of sorceries that only Rabbi Akiva, he had handed over to Rabbi Akiva. No one else knows it. No.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237, or call 1-800-797-7729.